You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into the frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome to Thursday's edition of the Turley Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Today on the show we are talking ivory-billed woodpeckers and their conservation with Matt Courtman from Mission Ivory Bill in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you're invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. In the final segment today, we continue to ask, have we found the lost Ark of the Covenant? Yes, maybe we know where it resides after all. Stay tuned to find out more. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Hello and welcome. I hope your Thursday morning is going well, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. However, you are enjoying Archangel Radio this morning. Now, I know there was a few technical bumps along the road this morning in LA Catholic Morning. Certainly on my stream there was. So I think we better just do a quick check of all our systems. Reed, are we ready to go here on the Turley Frequency?
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
Well, that's definitive. We are ready to launch into the radio sphere this morning here live on Archangel Radio. Now, we are going to be talking ivory-billed woodpeckers in the next segment, but before then, I have a few things to talk to you about happiness. Do you remember during the week we started talking about various surveys which told you about how to be happy? Do you remember if you ate 30 grams of nuts, 30 ounces of nuts or something, that would improve your mental health? Some survey that had been done in the UK. Anyway, the nut eaters of the United Kingdom are proving to be a happier bunch than the non-nut eaters of the United Kingdom. So there was other surveys done about that. And we talked about that earlier in the week. And it seems to be one of those themes, one of those mysterious themes that the Holy Spirit points us towards. What is it that makes us happy? And the Holy Scriptures have lots to say about that. But before we jump into that, my eyes spied an article in the New York Times this morning, and I thought, aha, this is right up my street, because the article's headline was as follows. The world's happiest man shares his three rules for life. Now, I don't know about you, who wouldn't click on that? Which is partly how these things are designed. We talked to Harry Brunius about this, do you remember, during the week, and how newspapers and the whole information overload that we're suffering. But something like that, when you see a headline which describes the world's happiest man, you think, well, who is he? I need to meet him. I need to find out his secret. And if he's sharing his three rules for life, then sign me up. I'm ready to go. And I have to say that I was less intrigued when I started reading. I mean, it's the New York Times, okay? This is not the National Catholic Register. So they're not going to put forward a 90-year-old nun who has dedicated her life to serving the poor and the helpless and the sick. And they're not going to find some Christian worker out in the wilds of some missionary territory who has dedicated their lives to spreading the gospel and is blissfully happy. No, it's the New York Times. So who do they find? They find a Buddhist monk. Of course they do. Not just any old Buddhist monk, it's a Tibetan Buddhist monk. There's something about Tibetan Buddhism which is very attractive to Westerners. And I say this as somebody who met the Dalai Lama and was involved in helping the Dalai Lama come to speak about interreligious dialogue. And it was very, very attractive to lots and lots of people because there's an awful lot of the iconography around Tibetan Buddhism, which people like. They like the idea of snow-capped hills and mountains with Buddhas and lamas sitting, meditating, you know, as the sun rises. And there's been an endless amount of films and documentaries done about this over the years, not least because so many of Hollywood's great and good are attracted to it. When I met the Dalai Lama, I also, in the same day, I met Richard Gere. He was introduced to me. I know. He didn't know who I was. Don't worry. But I met a whole other range of movie stars and TV stars. And they were being a Tibetan Buddhist or being part of that world is there's a certain cachet to it. There's a certain street cred on the streets of Hollywood. So it didn't surprise me when the New York Times dug up a Buddhist monk to tell us about happiness. Now, it turns out that he's not a Buddhist monk who grew up in that tradition, but somebody who was French or is French and became a Buddhist monk. So unfortunately, he was probably either, well, he could more than likely Catholic, but certainly Christian, possibly Jewish. But if he grew up in France and he's of a certain age, he would have probably been one of those three religions. Anyway, he's become a Buddhist. I thought, okay, let's have a look. Let's see what his secret is. And very, very quickly into the article, it tells you what his secret are. Or sorry, his three rules for happiness. Let's see what you think of these, okay? So the interviewer asks him, can you give us the three secrets of happiness? And his reply, first, there is no secret. Second, there's not just three points. Third, it takes a whole life, but it is the most worthy thing you can do. Answers on a postcard, please, as to what any of that meant. If you could send them to Archangel Studio Radio Studios, downtown Fairhope, Main Street, across the road from St. Lawrence Catholic Church, marked for the attention of the producer of the Turley Frequency.
Yeah, we Kevin, will find. I'm afraid that left me thoroughly confused.
Good. I'm not the only one. I'm sure it leaves us. But it also leaves us feeling anticlimactic.
Yep.
I mean, if at the start of this show I was going to say to you, I'm going to give you the three rules which are going to make you happy, you'd be turning the radio up. You'd be saying, right, what is it? And there if I go. Said, well, the first is there's no secret. The second, there's more than three points. And the third is spend your whole life searching for it. You'd switch the radio off.
Yeah, I'm afraid I would.
Yeah, you'd switch it off quicker than you're already switching it off out there. No, I'm only joking. Keep it on. Keep it on. Now, listen. So it got me thinking, though. It got me thinking. Now, it just so happens. Now, do you remember we talked about this? The Holy Spirit directs this show, okay? So it gives us certain themes each week, and happiness is definitely one of them. Definitely one of them. Because do you remember we talked about the nuts reducing unhappiness? But there was something else we talked about, because there was another survey very, very hot on its heels. And it was all about how hobbies reduced stress, tension, and depression. Do you remember? Now, I don't know how they did it. It was a London survey. Who knows? 8,000 adults, though, were quizzed, all over 50, which is interesting. And 72% of them reported that having a hobby over the course of 13 years, don't ask me why 13 years, it reduced their depression by 30%. 30%. Now, I mean, there's an element when I read that, it's sort of stating the obvious, right? It's stating the obvious. When I was young, when you were young, did your mother never say to you when you were sitting bored at home, find yourself something to do? Do you remember? Do you remember she used to say things like that? Or go out and play. Or find a book to read, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she was right. Mothers all over the world know the cure for depression, which is, I remember asking my mother when I was very young what the cure for depression was. And you know what she said? Shot it straight back at me, both barrels. She said, Kevin, hard work. She was right. Hard work is a good cure for depression, but of course it must not become a replacement for whatever is getting you depressed, because that's a whole different mania, which we need to get into. But anyway, basically, happiness and hobbies, right? If you're feeling a little bit under the weather, a little bit, I'm not talking about clinical depression, I'm talking about just feeling a little bit out of sorts, as we all do from time to time, right? Well, engage in your hobby. And you know what? A little voice will say to you, I'm absolutely certain of this. It's happened to me, and suddenly I've realized that that little voice has a tail. Let me explain what I mean. So you're feeling a bit under the weather for whatever reason. And you can do a number of things, right? You can wallow in it and just makes you feel worse. Or you could, I don't know, watch your favorite movie on DVD, or go for a walk, or listen to some music, or have a bath, or run around a track, or running out of things to do, whatever you do, play a musical instrument, drive a car, do whatever you want, whatever's your hobby, right? Clean your car. There's a man on my street, I must say, boy, he cleans his car so often. He loves cleaning his car. It gives him so much pleasure. Me, I don't really clean cars, but, you know, it's his thing. It obviously cheers him up. So what I'm trying to say is that get a hobby, do something. Now, the little voice will say to you, no, 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 don't do that. Deal with your problem. Ever heard this? You need to deal with your problem. No, you don't. We're body and soul. We are fallen human beings. There will be some days we're ecstatic and some days we're a bit depressed. That is life. We are ups and downs and round and rounds. The only time when we'll be happy all the time, please God, is when we get to that other place, the one we're all heading to, hoping to head to, hoping to get entry to. Do you remember? That's the only time. There was another video from our Buddhist friends I was looking at the other night. I don't know, it just jumped into my YouTube feed, and it was all about the Buddhist theory of life. I thought, oh yes, what's this? Clicked on it and it said, all life is suffering. I thought, crikey, I need this. Anyway, but he's right. All life is suffering. In some ways, he's echoing part of the Bible. He's echoing aspects of the Bible. The thing is that if we realize that we are passing through in this world, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. Do you remember that quote I gave you from St. Teresa of Avila, doctor of the church, 16th century enclosed Carmelite nun? She said, this life is like a night in a noisy inn. A night in a noisy inn. Now, we've all had nights in noisy inn, right? You don't get too upset about it. Why? Because you're checking out the next day. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Anyway, so this business with the hobbies. So today I clicked on another link and I saw a name which I thought, I think she's been on the show. And I checked it out and she is. Teresa Mull. Do you remember her? Do you remember Teresa came on, talked to us about her book, which was Woke Proof Your Life? Do you remember? She was good fun. I liked her. Anyway, she's just published an article over at The Federalist, which takes this hobby business a stage further. She says, I'll give you the title of her article, To Beat Leftist Groupthink, Put Down Your Phone and Pick Up a Hobby. Now, I'm sure she didn't write that title. It's a very Federalist title, if I may say. But there's something in it. What she's saying is that it's not just about increasing your mental health, making you feel a bit better by putting down your phone, which we've talked about in this show as well. But it also stops us from being bombarded with the messages which are on our phone. Now, I'm not talking about the messages from your friend, your long lost uncle in Japan or whatever it is. I'm talking about those endless sort of news feeds that we are tempted to look at. And they tend to be depressing, right? The news is depressing. It's always depressing. I mean, we talked about it yesterday. We talked about those wildfires in Hawaii or disasters or problems, people. We know that. The world is depressing. And you know what? In the old days, when I was a boy, you only got a fraction of all that bad news because actually there was nothing I could do about it. And today, in the 21st century, with all our technology, guess what? there's still very little we can do about it, except to pray. Do you remember we talked about that yesterday? We talked about praying. So Teresa in this article, it's very funny, actually. She's a very funny and very good writer. But, I mean, I won't go through it all, but she's basically saluting or suggesting to us all ordinary mundane tasks. Now, she's actually, I don't know if she's aware of it. She may be. She's actually plugging into something which a lot of Christian saints have written about. A lot of our Catholic heroes and heroines have said that Christ can be found in the simplicity of ordinary life. There's a wonderful book by Brother Lawrence all about the present moment. It's a beautiful book. It's very short. You can get a copy online probably straight away on a click of a button. And it's the most beautiful meditation on Christ being present in the ordinariness of everyday life, written back in the 1600s, I think. And Brother Lawrence was a cook. He was a member of a religious order, but he worked in the kitchens and he cooked the food and did the dishes, all that. So there's an awful lot of talking about the simplicity of his tasks and how they brought him closer to Christ. And it's absolutely beautiful. Recommend it. So there's nothing new in what Teresa and others are saying, but I think there's something in it. But I tell you what's also in this, which is spending less time with your phone. Now, I've started doing this almost by default. I've started switching the phone off more than ever. And I've also started, certainly at the weekends, of switching off the internet at home so that both computers and mobiles and everything are disconnected for periods of time. Now, I'm slowly weaning myself off it. But guess what? Guess what? I feel better the longer I'm away from it. It's paradoxical, I know. There's that initial dread of what? There's no internet, there's no phone, there's no computer. But you get over that quite quickly, actually. And then you realize it's actually quite relaxing. And then your mind starts stimulating in different ways. And you pick up a book. You start reading books like we're going to be talking about later, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of Mary. And then you suddenly realize that there are ways in which you can engage your mind which aren't all about distractions and blue lights and signing in and putting in passwords. And we're all tired of it, right? We're all so over it, as the young kids say these days. We're over it, putting in passwords and all that stuff, you know. I'm so glad I've still got an old FM and AM radio. I can just turn it on in the mornings and listen to whatever's the news, whatever, and turn it off. I don't have to constantly have to connect to this and upgrade to that. And yeah, we're all tired of it. That's what's causing so much depression and tiredness. Now, we're going to go in a minute. So I want to just tell you a very, very quick story. It's really going to cheer you up. It's going to make you smile. EWTN was starting out in Norway. Did you hear about this? So they were starting out in Norway and they had an official launch on August 15th, just a few days ago. Okay. And before its launch, the editor-in-chief, whose name I won't try to pronounce, was hosting a big three-day event when he was planning to film at five locations across Norway in honor of the patron saint of Norway, Saint Olaf. But just before the venture started, his film crew were not able to make the trip, right? Think about it. 3 days of filming was to be had. Of intense filming, and suddenly he didn't have a film crew. Nobody, nothing. He was on his tod, right, as we say. He was sitting there on his own. So what did he do? No, he did not get depressed. What he did was he started praying. And he prayed to two people. He prayed to St. Rita, who we mentioned the other day, patron saint of hopeless causes, do you remember? One of them. And Mother Angelica. And he got up from the church and he walked outside and he could not believe his eyes. Outside in the yard was a French platoon of Boy Scouts. Now, you've seen these. If anybody's been to any religious events in Europe, you see these platoons of French Boy Scouts, Catholic Boy Scouts. And they were named after St. Maximilian Kolbe. And it just so happened, he got speaking to them, and it just so happened that a number of them were trained as cameramen and one was a French television producer. And they all agreed to help him. And he had the greatest time filming for 3 days. So that's the cure to unhappiness. Get down on your knees and ask the Lord. When we come back, we are going to be looking around us for the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is under threat in all sorts of ways. But it is native to Alabama, so let's find out. Some people say it's extinct, others not. Our next guest probably has a view on that. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Charlie Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I hope your Thursday morning is going well, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. I'm your host, Kevin Turley. And, well, the next subject is very, very interesting. Have you ever wondered if the ivory-billed woodpecker is extinct or not? Now, this is a bird which is indigenous to the southwestern U.S. seaboard and certainly was known to Alabama and this the lower Alabama where we broadcast to. But since 1997, some people think that that bird is no longer with us. Now, my next guest should have a good idea as to whether it still exists or not. His name is Matthew Courtman, and with his wife, Lauren, he founded Mission Ivory Bill, which is a grassroots project that seeks to help save the ivory-billed woodpecker by opposing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's delisting proposal, and also by organizing and leading a systemic search for the bird throughout its extensive and potential habitat, and that includes lower Alabama, while engaging and educating the public about these amazing birds. And I'm delighted to be joined down the line this morning by Matthew Courtman. Matt, welcome to the Frequency.
So much. I'm delighted to be here. I was really ecstatic to find that y'all existed, because this is exactly where Lauren and I found ourselves, is the connectivity between our religious faith and the culture. And the ivory-billed problem is essentially a people person problem and a cultural and, for us, religious problem. So, well, that's happy to have found y'all.
No, we're extremely happy to have you on the show, Matthew. Is it Matthew or Matt? I don't want to get it wrong.
It's Matt. Thanks.
Matt. Okay, Matt. Yep. Good to have you on the show. Now, I think we better back up a little bit, because there may be somebody out there listening who doesn't really know much about woodpeckers. And now you are an expert on it. And with experts, I find that sometimes they're way ahead of the rest of us. So let's back up a little bit. Can we talk in general about the United States and woodpeckers? You know, what sort of varieties are they? Are they particularly predominant in certain geographic areas?
Not surprisingly, woodpeckers are limited to wood. So they're found in all the forests of the United States. But just to drill down, no pun, on the ivory-billed woodpecker, in the U.S. and certainly in Alabama, we only have two really large crow-sized woodpeckers, the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is our bird, and then the pileated, P-I-L-E-A-T-E-D, woodpecker. They're twice the size of any other woodpeckers. The ivory bill is slightly larger than the pileated. And the ivory billed, again, thank you for the whole expert thing. Don't let me bore your audience like the uncle at, you know, who talks about stamps every time we talk to him. So if I'm getting into too much detail, let me know. But to set the context, the ivory bill is a member of the Campephalus genus. So, right, there's the it's Campephalus principalis. So there are 11 members of this genus, and it's a Western Hemisphere genus. The ivory bill is the only American one, a member of that genus. And so the pileated, I'm just, for your audience, I'm just making it clear. The pileated, which is fairly common, superficially looks like the ivory bill, except the back, which is really the folded wings when it's perched. Hilliard's back is all black, and the Ivoryville's black back is half white. But the habitat is quite different. The Ivoryville is only found in the deep woods, and it's controversial as to typically it's thought that the Ivoryville is only found in the deep hardwoods, what we would call the bottomland hardwood forests of the southeastern United States. And lower Alabama does still have some good habitat, and there have been reports from there. But in general, the Ivoryville is not extinct. It's not been declared extinct by just, again, I don't want to lose your audience in too much detail, but the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a is under the Department of Interior, has been granted by Congress rulemaking authority. And part of that is the Endangered Species Act. And the reason the Ivoryville is in the news is in September of 2021, Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to declare the Ivoryville extinct and remove it from the Endangered Species Act. And that's why this was is in the news, and that's why Lauren and my wife, Lauren, and thank you for that introduction, we did, just briefly about my background, I'm a former Louisiana Ornithological Society president. I've studied the Ivoryville for over 50 years because I had a great mentor, George Lowry, L-O-W-E-R-Y, who was at LSU. And Dr. Lowry founded essentially the LSU Museum of Natural Science. Dr. Lowry is very important to the Ivoryville because the Ivoryville, after the war between the states, became less and less common because of the efficiency of northern timber operations that came down and started cutting the Ivoryville's habitat, which again is primarily the deep swamp woods. So the Ivoryville,
Sorry, Matt, you're already sort of way, you're beginning to lose, certainly get, there's so much in this, because this is starting to get really interesting, and we can blame it all on the Yankees. I like this. But but in all seriousness, let's go back a little bit, because the delisting just didn't happen out of the blue. Somebody determined.
Let me interrupt you because you're going down the wrong path. The bird has not been delisted. It will not be delisted. So to be very clear, and that's been what's frustrating for me, there's been a lot of lazy journalism about this. Right. So Fish and Wildlife Service, and again, I want to be very clear. I'm a almost lifelong fan of Fish and Wildlife Service, and the almost meaning it wasn't until I was eight till I started to do things with Fish and Wildlife Service as a kid. I was very lucky. I had my second grade teacher, Mrs. Rory Reiser, here in Lexington Elementary School in Monroe, Louisiana, got me interested in birds. And apparently I had a facility for birds, so an ability to identify them. So I took a college ornithology class when I was eight. And I'm about to engage in a little, this is going to sound haughty, but I had, by the time I was nine, I had completed more college ornithology classes than the Fish and Wildlife Service Ivoryville expert, who's never taken, as far as I know, a college ornithology class. And here's the problem is, again, this I'm always clear when I'm just speculating. The following is speculation. There can't be any scientific background for declaring the Ivoryville extinct and delisting it. And just so the reason that's true is there are two components to knowing something's not there. The first component is looking for it. The second component is not finding it. So while it's ambiguous, I've seen the Ivoryville. We have very good audio recordings. I brought in the National Aviary from Pittsburgh, and they have some excellent drone video and some game cam images. But I would say that the state of the evidence to me is clear, but it might be ambiguous to some. But that's only the second problem. Here's a very, very important first. Let me just complete this point.
Sure.
The first component of knowing something's not there is looking. And objectively, we have not sufficiently looked for the Ivoryville, and that's why Fish and Wildlife Service will not be able to declare the bird extinct, and the bird won't be delisted. And just summing this up, there's a document called the 2016 Technical Report to the Fish and Wildlife Service, which says very clearly it would be premature to declare the ivory bill extinct because we haven't adequately searched for it. And the final thing, sorry to push this point, is that the ivory bill lives in a very remote area. It's in the deep swamp woods where no birders go. And the only people who I've been interested in the ivory bill for over 50 years, and Lauren and I devoted our lives to saving the bird full time over the last 4 years. So, in just in those 4 years, since I've really known what I was doing, I've spent over 2,000 hours in the ivory bill woods, and that I think I calculated that 7.2 million seconds. And of the 7.2 million seconds, I've seen ivory bills on five occasions for an aggregate of about 20 seconds. So wow. 7.2 million seconds to 20 seconds. And so that's what I don't think people realize, and it's never reported very well, is you have to be where the birds are. There are no birders there. And the people who are most sure that the ivory bill can be declared extinct are the people with zero experience in our deep southern hardwood forests where, again, bird watchers aren't to be found. So it's also, and then please stop me with questions, but there's another problem with the media narrative is there's a real inversion of authority. So no qualified PhD ornithologist that I know of think that the ivory bill can be declared extinct. In fact, back to the Alabama connection, the Brewster, Brewster medal is the highest award in ornithology. Jeff Hill at Auburn is a Brewster medal winner who wrote what I consider to be the best searching book for the of the ivory bill, The Ivory Bill's Hunters. And in that, Jeff Hill, Brewster medal winner from Auburn, described his sighting in 2006 in the Florida Panhandle. Right. Along the Choctaw Hatchie, and there was a lot of evidence from there. So just summing up, there aren't any qualified PhD ornithologists who think the ivory bill can be declared extinct. Here's supposition on our part, complete supposition, because I have tried to get Fish and Wildlife Service to share with me the basis of their science for declaring the ivory bill extinct, and they can't. Trust me, you'll never have access to the ivory bill woodpecker expert for Fish and Wildlife Service. She'll never come in public and just answer questions. Lauren and I have put together over 50 Zoom presentations, right, where people can come and they can talk to experts. And they are the first and third Mondays of the month. So this Monday at 7 p.m. Central, we'll have Christopher Kokinas, who wrote a great book called Hope is the Thing with Feathers. But the important part of what Lauren and I have been trying to do is to build a community around understanding. It's not just the ivory bill. The bird itself is certainly important, but it's much more important to us with our religious faith and protecting the environment. I'll read, and I want to be very clear, Lauren and I are not environmentalists. We are dominionists, which means we follow the Bible as the whole word of God, and so we accept Genesis as, you know, the dominion mandate of Genesis, which is man is given, to sum up, nature, the wild things, for man's benefit. So if it came down to protecting the ivory-billed woodpecker or protecting jobs, we'd be for protecting jobs because we're for man. But sure. It doesn't come down to that.
You're listening to Matthew Kortman, who is part of the Ivory Billed Woodpecker project that we are discussing this morning. If you have any questions for Matthew, call us on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be straight back after these words. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Thank you. Welcome back to Charlie Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in a fascinating conversation this morning with Matthew Courtman, who is part of the Mission Ivory Bill, which is a grassroots project to help save the ivory billed woodpecker, which is indigenous to, amongst other places, Alabama. Matthew, just before the break, you were alluding to your Christian belief or Christian faith there. Is that part, I mean, would you say that that's the preeminent stimulus for your involvement with this, that this is a wonderful, this creature is a wonderful creation of the Father of God, and you are reminding people that God's creation still exists in regard to that beautiful animal?
Well, Kevin, you couldn't have said it better. If you don't mind, the quote that animates us, and you said it exactly correctly, is from the preamble to the Louisiana Birds, a state publication in 1931. And this was the opening quote from William Leon Dawson, who was a minister. He said, among other things, "Birds belong to the people, not to a clique or a coterie, but to all of the people as heirs and stewards of the good things of God." That's what Lauren and I are always trying to remind people. And again, before the break, we were talking about Lauren and I are not environmentalists. We're dominionists, which means man is preeminent. But it's not an either-or situation with the ivory bill. We, in answer to your question, broadly, I have two, and Lauren too, but I have two motivations for this. The first thing, of course, is religious. It is up to us to preserve God's order and yes. to protect the defenseless. And frankly, the ivory bill is almost completely defenseless against interests which want it declared extinct and delisted. So that's the principle orientation for us, is it's a God-given duty. For me, frankly, it's Ephesians 2:10. I have the unique combination of having been an expert on the birds of Louisiana since I was 8. There's that. And I'm a recovering lawyer. I'm a graduate of a top 10 law school, University of Alabama, where my best professor, I mean, the University of Virginia is where I graduated, but I was stuck on Dan Metter, who was from Alabama and had taught there. He was my best professor in law school. Anyhow, the point of the story is, for the context, again, this is a legal issue, whether or not the ivory bill can be legally removed from federal protection under the Endangered Species Act. And that then in turn becomes a scientific question. As I said, there's no science behind it, so I'm not going to fill in what I think to be the motives. Back to your question, thank you so much. We have a religious duty, and the other duty I have, and I get misty when I say it, is I mentioned before Dr. George Lowry. When I was 8, I wrote to George Lowry, who's from my hometown and where Lauren and I live. We're from Monroe, Louisiana, in the northeastern part of the state. But Dr. Lowry was a fantastic field biologist. His PhD was in mammalogy from the University of Kansas, but he built the LSU Museum of Natural Science. And Dr. Lowry, like Jeff Hill, was a Brewster Medal winner. At any rate, Dr. Lowry, I wrote to him when I was 8 to ask if he thought the ivory bill still existed. And he immediately wrote me back and said, come visit me the next time you're in Baton Rouge, and we'll talk about it. So, again, I get misty when I tell the story. My father and I happened to be going down for an LSU thrashing of Mississippi State in football that next Saturday. So Dr. Lowry, Tiger Stadium traffic was as bad in 1969 as it is now. So nonetheless, Dr. Lowry waded through post-game traffic, and at about 10:30 on that Saturday night, he opened up the LSU Museum of Natural Science to let me hold two ivory bill woodpecker specimens. And Dr. Lowry told me, in answer to the question, does the ivory bill still persist, he gave the objective answer, which is no one can responsibly say how many ivory bills exist because of its deep swamp woods habitat, where no one, frankly, has searched. So that was true in 1936. 1965 when there was an article written on this. It was true in 1969 when Dr. Lowry told me that, and it's true in 2023. And so that's why Lauren and I, again, our commitment is to do a systematic
thorough. I'm just wondering, Matthew, if there's also something which you've just, alluded to there, which is that science demands proof, whereas people of faith like you and I, there's times where you have to believe first before you see it. And in a way, your search for this wonderful creature, the ivory-billed woodpecker, is a kind of a little parable about faith, really, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Kevin, I'm so happy to have found y'all. It absolutely is. Christians are comfortable, and I'm going to be obnoxious and speak for Christians. I'll speak for myself. As a Christian, I'm comfortable with the idea of not knowing. This is God's creation. The Lord's mind is not our mind, saith the Lord. So there are things that we don't understand. I know the ivory bill exists from my own observation. Again, I'm an expert on the birds of Louisiana. I was published, as a boy as such for my sighting. So I unequivocally know that the ivory bill still exists. The issue is proving it to third parties. Now that the delisting proposal will not go through, that would have been the biggest threat to the ivory bill's persistence, because had the delisting proposal gone through, there's a possibility that the public forests where ivory bills live, the deep swamp woods, would have been fragmented through logging. And so the Endangered Species Act stops that. And again, Lauren and I are dominionists. We don't care what people do with their own private property. We're only talking about public land. And for us, for now, our search is primarily on Tensaw. That's T-E-N-S-A-S, just like the river in Alabama. But Tensaw River National Wildlife Refuge, which is near Tallulah, Louisiana, it's 45 miles away from Lauren and me. And it's a fantastic spot. The last known large population of ivory bills was in the old Singer Tract, S-I-N-G-E-R, tract in northeast Louisiana, where most of what we think we know about the ivory bill, that came out of a book in 1942 written by Jim Tanner, who Jim Tanner made all of his observations in the same woods where we've seen the ivory bills. So that was in the 40s. And summing up on that place, Teddy Roosevelt wrote from there in 1907. He wrote an article called The Louisiana Cane Breaks. And in that, his article, he described the highlight of the bear hunt as seeing three ivory-billed woodpeckers near the same spot where we've seen them. So.
Matthew, I have a few questions that have come in. We're running out of time, though, so you may just have to give rather shortened answers to some of these. I mean, there's a general one here, which is that is the ivory-billed woodpecker solely in this part of the United States, or are there ivory-billed woodpeckers in other parts of the world?
That's a great question. The answer is no. There are related species in Cuba and Mexico, but our species is Campephalus principalis principalis. It's a bird of the southeastern deep swamp woods. I have found a specimen from the 19th century in the middle Indiana, Monroe County, Indiana. Right. But in general, it's a southeastern United States bird.
Right. And there's another question here, which is it's a bit sort of technical, I guess, which is why the pileated is still so common, and yet the ivory billed is less common. Is it something to do with the diet, or is it just purely about habitat?
That's a great question. Diet and habitat are related. So one of the things about the pileateds is that their favorite food is carpenter ants, which are fairly ubiquitous and easy to find. So they're not as limited as we think. Let me say everything we think we know about the ivory bill, take it with a grain of salt. But here's the theory is that the ivory bill is a more specialized eater. And so its favorite food is the beetle larvae, which are found in the mostly in old growth trees. And again, it's too simple an answer, but the beetles have to have a way to get into the tree to implant their larvae. So you need damaged trees in the first place. And so the older the tree, the more likely there is to be damage. So that's a great question, but the short answer is it's probably diet. The ivory Bilbo was hunted for not only for subsistence for people to eat, but as it became more rare and more obviously so, it's a magnificent bird. It's called the Lord God Bird is its nickname, because when people would see it for the first time, and I can attest to this, excuse me, they would exclaim something about, good God, what a bird, or something like that. Anyhow, the ivory bill, I know where there are 413 specimens of the ivory bill. It became not only very important for museums. I think the Harvard Museum has about 85 specimens, but they became novelty pieces. So the ivory bills were hunted in a way that Pileates weren't also. So two things. One, destruction of habitat, which relates to diet. And the other is that they were killed in large numbers.
Excellent. Another question here, which is alluding to your own mission, really, I suppose, Matthew. It says, please explain why there is not a more concrete scientific evidence to support its return from extinction. I think the questioner is assuming it's come back from extinction. It's never actually been extinct, as you've explained, Matthew. But is there any institutions that are proposing some sort of large-scale scientific research about this?
Yes, that's a great question. The short answer is there's lots of evidence of the ivory bill. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2005, through the Secretary of Department of Interior, unequivocally accepted the 2004 video in Arkansas from our friend David Luneau, and there were many sightings, and there's audio. I could go on and on. The evidence exists, but the point of the story is Lauren and I, through Mission Ivory Bill, are trying to get better evidence, and we're systematically studying and searching for the bird. But I brought in the National Aviary. Look them up, and they've done – we basically are complementary to each other. We're more the public face. We want to get people interested in – again, we're interested in getting children engaged with the glory and mystery of God's creation – the great outdoors. So that's our primary mission. The ivory bill is just part of that. Although committed to that.
To that end, Matthew, do you and your wife, do you lead sort of, do you go on hunts for this bird in its yes. habitat?
Yes. During July and August are our slow months. So we're only maybe once or twice a week, but in the rest of the year, we're full-time operation. I'm in the field about 5 days a week, and we have people we've had people from, I think now, 13 states and the United Kingdom and Canada come to search for us. But it takes some outdoor skills to do this, but anybody can contact me. It's Matt, M-A-T-T, at missionivorybill.org, Matt@missionivorybill.org, and we're happy to have volunteers, and we've had some fantastic people come in. So yes, we're very actively searching, but our real goal is to help other people search too. And we've put on, look us up on YouTube, Mission Ivory Bill. we'll put more of our Zoom presentations up. Again, we've done over 50 of them, but we have very helpful Zooms for identifying ivory bills and how to search for ivory bills.
That's wonderful. It would have been great to have you on location, Matthew, on the hunt for the ivory-billed woodpecker. That would have been fun
to
have you reporting from that.
Kevin, I hate to interrupt, but this is such a vital point. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service in 2010 accepted that the ivory bill still existed because they implemented their ivory-billed woodpecker recovery plan. Very important. Since 2010, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has not searched for the ivory bill. And I don't say that as a slur for the ivory bill, but the point is the Fish and Wildlife Service has no direct information. They only rely on those of us who do the searching, and it's a very expensive, dangerous, time-consuming, fantastic adventure. But no one who's actively searching for the ivory bill agrees that the bird can be delisted as extinct, and again, it won't be delisted, but...
Matthew, believe it or not, we have run out of time. I've just had a text in from a listener saying, I'm going to go on one of these missions. So you've already got somebody interested.
Matt@missionivorybill.org.
Mission Ivory Dill. Matthew, listen, thank you so much for what you do. I hope that God will bless you in this search for this wonderful creature and that you behold it at some time. And as you do, you can give praise to God.
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, brother.
That was Matthew Courtman from Mission Ivory Bill, which is a project to, as you heard, to seek out the ivory-billed woodpecker. Okay, when we come back, we are going to be seeking out the mercy of God with a Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.